and their children, Rabbi Feldman, welcome.
Thank you very much. In general, Rabbi Dr. Reichman is already a tough act to follow. The slides are also a very tough act to follow. I don't have any fascinating slides. I apologize for that. But hopefully we'll be able to address the topic fully without it, or at least some type of perspective on the topic this morning, the topic of medical confidentiality, which is a very thorny and complicated topic in its own right. I think we take it as a given that in the absence of any pressing need, so medical confidentiality would be assumed, that if one doesn't have any real reason to divulge the medical information of somebody else, so then one would understand that this is something that is meant to be kept private, both for reasons that are halakhic and reasons that are civil and reasons that are legal. And we'll talk about some of those in a moment. But the complexities set in when we have a conflict, when we have other reasons why there might be a compelling reason to reveal something. And included in these compelling reasons, on the one hand, might be if treatment of the patient himself requires revealing something that would otherwise be kept confidential. And in addition to that, if for some reason the patient with his condition poses some type of a threat to someone else. And that could include either because the patient is going to get involved with somebody else in a close relationship, most likely marriage, and somehow it's going to impact on the decision to get married, on the life of the marriage, on things like that. So that would be an issue. That would be a reason why there might be a potential need to reveal medical information about somebody who's in that setting. Or other situations would be if somebody's condition poses a threat to others. As we'll see, the post can talk about, let's say somebody is prone to epileptic fits, and he wants to drive, and therefore poses a risk in terms of his driving. So that's an issue that folks can talk about as well. And perhaps something that might come to mind more quickly would be the question of somebody who's potentially contagious. If somebody could pose a risk to transmit the disease to others, transmit an illness to others, so that might be what comes to our mind first. It's interesting that in the halakhic literature, in this specific case, you find that discussed less. Presumably would follow some of the same rules and principles that we'll talk about, but that would perhaps come to mind first as one of the crucial reasons why one might want to reveal such information. So to try to look at how some of these tensions are balanced and to try to look at some of the principles that are brought out, so in general, there are basically, you could broadly categorize it as two sets of issues. Let's say two sets of reasons why things are confidential, why there is a premise of a certain confidentiality. And we'll broadly group them into what we might call Lashon Hara issues. That'll be the first set of issues. And the second set will be ethical issues, professional issues, issues of interpersonal commitments, things like that, that would also dictate a certain type of confidentiality. We'll try to look at those two sets separately and how they impact on each other. So first of all, to begin with, in terms of Lashon Hara issues, so we know that we generally refer to Lashon Hara, we're talking about somebody who says something disparaging about somebody else, somebody who says something specifically negative that somebody else did, or somebody's characteristics are negative. That's usually what we're talking about when we refer to Lashon Hara. However, it is a broader category as well. And there is a prohibition which is understood to be a subset of Lashon Hara, which is called Gilui Sod. Person is going to reveal somebody else's secrets, so even if it's not inherently disparaging, and if it doesn't say necessarily anything bad the person did, or anything that's the person's fault, if it's something private, so then there is a prohibition, and that's understood to be somewhat of a subset, somewhere related to the prohibition of Lashon Hara, included within that prohibition. Partially because the primary pasuk which prohibits Lashon Hara in the Torah, the truth is there are a number of candidates for what the primary pasuk is, but the most often quoted pasuk is the pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. The Torah tells us, Lo Seilech Rachel B'Amecha, that we should not travel as a talebearer, we should not go around telling stories. And the pasuk in Mishle has the expression, Holech Rachel Megalasod, that one of the things that a person who is a rochel does, a person who is a talebearer, one of the things he does is he reveals secrets. So it's generally understood that if somebody reveals a secret, so that is itself considered to be a prohibition, included within the prohibition of Lashon Hara. The Gemara in Maseches Yuma in the beginning has a perhaps more expansive statement, where the Gemara seems to say that anything somebody tells you, the default is it's private. If somebody tells you something and doesn't explicitly say, you can tell somebody else. So the Gemara calls that the Baal Tomer, you shouldn't say, you shouldn't speak, you shouldn't repeat it. You have to take a presumption of confidentiality on anything that anyone tells you unless explicitly stated otherwise. The poskim don't necessarily take it that severely. For example, the Tshuvas B'Tzel HaChachma of Rabbi Tal Stern. So we understand that that Gemara really is talking more in terms of Derech Eretz, that's more good manners, that it's worth always confirming that anything anybody tells you is for public information. But in terms of the prohibition of Gilui Sod, we're talking about something that's clearly a secret. If somebody tells you something in confidence, somebody tells you something when nobody else is around, if the nature makes it clear that it's something that would be private, so then to reveal that, that would be prohibited as far as Gilui Sod, as far as revealing a secret is concerned. And the Gemara's expression about anything is a default confidential, that's more of a Derech Eretz, and that's more flexible when there's a greater tension that's coming up against it. But in addition to that, so besides things that people tell you specifically, and then there's assumption of confidentiality perhaps, so anything that could be hurtful to a person in any way, so the Rambam understands that that's included in the definition of Lashon Hara. The Rambam states in Hilchos Deis, where he talks about the prohibitions of Lashon Hara, the Rambam was really one of the primary codifiers of the laws of Lashon Hara. So he has two separate statements in defining Lashon Hara, and it could be that it's two separate concepts, as we'll talk about in a moment. That first he says that anybody who says anything disparaging about somebody, that's Lashon Hara. Then he goes on to say that if somebody says something about somebody else, if somebody reveals some information, that that information could be harmful to the person. Whether it's harmful to them physically, whether it's harmful to them materially, whether it creates problems just because it scares them or it annoys them, it does something to cause somebody some type of discomfort or some type of problem, so revealing that is called Lashon Hara as well. And apparently, even if a person doesn't have any type of negative intent, even if a person is not trying to be hurtful, if bringing this information out into the public, that would also be included in Lashon Hara if it's going to cause some type of problems for the person. It's also important to point out that the flip side, not just in terms of revealing, but also those who would want to find out the information, if somebody seeks out somebody else's private information, so there is an issue with that as well, which may also be included within Lashon Hara, that expressing an interest in things that are not relevant to you, that are about other people's business, so there is an attitude that that's also included somehow within Lashon Hara. For example, the Tshuvas Halachas Ketanas has a statement that he thought this was also included in Rechilas, because the whole image of the rochel, of the peddler who travels from place to place with his stories, so he says, this is also Rechi, you look to get something to bring for yourself. So he has this expression, mali rochel acher, mali rochel atzmo. What difference does it make if I go take a story and bring it somewhere else, or if I go find a story for myself and bring it back to me? Either way, he says, that's Rechila, so looking into other people's private business, he thought was also, in general, a Lashon Hara issue. Some more contemporary Svarim have an idea also, that based on the Rambam's idea that anything that we mentioned before, that anything that's being private, anything private being revealed, anything that a person would be annoyed if it was revealed, that's also Begadol Lashon Hara. So if I'm looking into something that somebody else is keeping private, so presumably he wouldn't want to tell me. So some suggest that Lashon Hara is not just if I take the information and tell it to somebody else, but if I obtain it and tell it to myself. So he doesn't want me to know. He wants it to be kept confidential. So I'm essentially telling Lashon Hara to myself by looking into it. So some suggest that that's also, again, included in this broad rubric of Lashon Hara. So presumably, on the one hand, we start off with a presumption that there is an issue of Lashon Hara in revealing somebody else's private information, not only information about their misdeeds or about their bad characteristics, but anything that could be hurtful to them, anything that they would not want out, anything they would consider private, strictly speaking, does seem to be within a broad setting of Lashon Hara. However, we also know that Lashon Hara is often necessarily balanced with other issues. And this is a category that's known as toelis, that if you have something that they have a pressing need, the best example of a pressing need is if somebody else is at risk, or if the person himself is at risk, and revealing this information will stop that risk, will do something to save somebody who is at risk. So then, toelis outweighs Lashon Hara. Toelis It's like a complicated issue, as we'll discuss, but Toelas, at least in theory, is something which not only permits, but often requires Lashon Hara to be spoken. So whatever issues we have coming from a Lashon Hara perspective would have to be viewed through the prism of Toelas. Now the problem is, Toelas is extraordinarily complicated. Toelas is really where all the judgment in Hilchos Lashon Hara lies. It's where all of life experience has to come into play, and where we often find a need to consult with people who are more experienced and more knowledgeable, because this is really where the judgment is. How do we decide when something is a justifiable Toelas, when something is a required Toelas, when it has to be revealed and when it shouldn't be revealed? It's a very tricky question. The Sefer called Pischei Tshuva on Arachayim, not the famous Pischei Tshuva on the bottom of the Yeridea, one of the Dayanim in Vilna about 150 years ago, I think writing before the Chafetz Chaim, so he has a statement where he says, everybody gets so worked up about Lashon Hara, everybody's so concerned about what they shouldn't say, they should be equally concerned about what they have to say. That sometimes there are times when there's a requirement to say something, and that's very crucial, it's going to be very important, and people aren't always so aware of that, and he wanted to make a statement about that. And a lot of later poskim quoted that comment, and Rav Moshe Sternberg, for example, has a tshuva, which I think is very much to the point, which is, you know, such a movement to study Hilchos Lashon Hara and to focus much attention on studying the subject. I think part of it is because it's really not a simple subject. It's a very complicated judgment call to know when you are forbidden to say something and when you're obligated to say something, to very weighty issues on either side of the equation, and that's why it really requires a lot of study and a lot of judgment and a lot of experience. And part of the issue is that essentially we have a little bit of a question as to how do we understand the concept, how do we understand the theory of what Toelas means. Why should it be that something which is otherwise prohibited all of a sudden becomes permitted or obligatory? And there are two fundamental ways of approaching it. And the two ways of approaching it, they could be they're both true, could be one is true, could be a half of one is true, but the two fundamental perspectives say a lot about what we're trying to figure out. But on the one hand, there is the aspect that Lashon Hara is considered to be a negative character trait. It's considered to be the quality of being a gossip, of talking about the dirt, so to speak, of talking about people's problems, talking about people's issues. So that's considered to be a negative character trait. So there are those who feel that the heter of Toelas, that the license to say something that is of need, is there because that's simply not Lashon Hara. That is simply not what the Torah is talking about. When the Torah says, don't be a gossip, lo say lech rachel b'yamech, which perhaps has that connotation, like we're saying, don't be a gossipy person. So if we're motivated by something significant, so then that's simply not a part of this definition. That's simply not included in what's going on. There are those who note the Gemara has another candidate for the prohibition of Lashon Hara, not just this pasuk of Lo Say Lech Rachel. There's a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim that the Torah says in context of something else, but the Gemara understands it to be also related to Lashon Hara. So the Torah says, Lo Sisa Shema Shav, which the Gemara understands as the prohibition of both receiving Lashon Hara, the famous prohibition not to be Mekabel Lashon Hara, and also perhaps the prohibition of transmitting Lashon Hara. So what does it mean, Lo Sisa Shema Shav? You shouldn't bear a report, you shouldn't accept a report that is shav. So what does the word shav mean? So that's the whole discussion. I won't get into it now, but there are some who suggest that shav means meaningless, pointless. You shouldn't accept a report, a negative report, for no reason. But if there's a good reason, if there's some type of issue that has to be addressed by sharing this report, so then maybe that's simply not in this definition. That's not called shav. That's an important report. That's a consequential report. And maybe that's not even included in what we're talking about. Rav Huttner, in his letters in Igros Pachad Yitzchak, he favors that view that simply something that is l'toela, something that has a purpose, is not considered Lashon Hara at all. While alternatively, there are those who understand it a little differently, that maybe Lashon Hara is not just about the quality that involves, it's not just about the character trait, but it's about a Torah prohibition not to hurt someone through speech. That if we say something that could be damaging to somebody, so it's not only that we're prohibited from physically hurting people, but if we hurt people through our mouths, if we say something that could cause people problems, so that's also a Torah prohibition. So in the normal cases that we talk about of Toelas, if we're going to talk about somebody who's going to marry somebody, or somebody who's going to enter into a business deal with somebody, and we say that we have to reveal the information, so would that be Lashon Hara under that definition? For sure, it definitely is Lashon Hara. However, it's outweighed by something else. It's outweighed by another mitzvah. We have a mitzvah of lo samod al dam reacha, that we're not allowed to stand by when somebody else is at risk. And what does it mean when we say risk? So the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs understands that it means any type of physical risk, not just death, but any type of physical harm or any type of material harm. Dam reyacha, so dam in biblical literature and Talmudical literature has a dual meaning. It can mean a person's life or it can mean a person's money. So in both cases, if somebody's money or a person or somebody is at risk in any one of these broad senses of risk, so it's not appropriate, it's prohibited, strictly speaking, for a person to allow that risk to take place if they can intervene. So a person who can make a difference, who can stop somebody else from getting hurt, is obligated to do so. So that's how some understand that essentially we have a tension here, that there is on the one hand, yes, you're hurting somebody through saying the bad news about him that's going to stop him from getting a shaykh, going to stop him from getting a business deal, something like that, for sure that is lashon hara on the one hand. But on the other hand, you have an overwhelming imperative to protect an innocent victim, to protect something else, to accomplish some goal, lo samar al dam reyacha, is going to outweigh it. So essentially, that gives us two models. That on the one hand, the purposeful type of lashon hara might not be lashon hara at all, might not be included in the basic definition. Or it's a tension, it's a balance that we're trying to figure out between these two competing ideals of not hurting someone through speech, but not letting innocent people get hurt from lack of knowledge. So what's the difference between whether you take one view or the other? Well, the first view is much broader. The first view allows you to basically do whatever you need to do if there is a toelis, if there's any type of a purpose, if there's any type of a need that makes it not, strictly speaking, gossip, makes it not absolute nothing, so then it would simply, it would apparently be permitted. However, if we view it as a tension, which does seem to clearly be there just in real life in addition to the halachic sources, so then that puts a greater burden of judgment on us, that puts a greater requirement of analysis on us to try to figure out how justifiable is the lashon hara. So that's a tricky question, and that's again part of where all the judgment lies and where we sometimes find cases where it's prohibited, and sometimes we find cases where it's obligatory. And then we also find cases in between, which is a little bit harder to understand. So for example, in the context of shiduchim, so there's often a rule, some things you have to reveal right off the bat, and there are some things that if the family, if the potential spouse asks you, then you have to answer. So one could ask, so why should there be that in-between category? If we're saying that everything is deriving from lo samar al dam reyacha, that you have to protect an innocent victim, so why are these things that you have to wait if they ask you? It shouldn't make a difference. Either you shouldn't be allowed to say it, or you should be obligated to advertise the information even if nobody comes and asks you. So why do you have this in-between categories? That's a discussion that the later Sfarim have, and some explain that it's part of this tension, it's part of this balance, that there are some things which are objective problems. There are some things which you know that nobody would want to marry a person who has this issue. And then you have a real issue of being obligated to volunteer the information. But there are other things which people have different attitudes about, which people are going to be more or less concerned about. It's something they wouldn't necessarily think to ask about because it wouldn't bother them. But if you're going to bring it up, then they'll say, oh, you know what, I have so many people I can go out with, so I won't go out with that person. And then they're going to miss out on what could be a great shidduch for them. So some of the posts can understand that if they're not going to ask you about these kind of things, so then it's not a clear hezek, it's not a clear damage to them, and you will be more clearly damaging the person who you're talking about, because then they'll say, well, why should I deal with any kind of imperfection whatsoever? And maybe that's the issue, but in terms of the balance, so we want to protect the, so to speak, innocent party coming in when it's either an objective issue or it's an issue that they have clearly expressed that they are concerned about. But if it's not something that's so objective and they haven't clearly expressed that it's something that bothers them, so then it would be something that perhaps there would be more of a tilt towards protecting the person who you would theoretically be talking about. So these are some of the issues that some of the posts can talk about. And there's also a clear relationship between the potential spouse, for example, if we focus on marriage discussions, so things that the spouse is obligated, or the dating person is obligated to reveal on their own, and things that other people who know about them would be obligated to reveal if they're not going to reveal. So the discussions are often in one setting or the other, but they're essentially interchangeable. There are certain things that the person dating is obligated to reveal or may not be obligated to reveal, and if they don't do so, somebody else who knows the information may be in a position to reveal it, to be required to reveal it, in light of what we've been talking about. So it's a tricky question, because in addition to the kind of things which pose some type of harm, some type of loss to somebody else. So then there's a trickier issue when you get involved, for example, in Kiddushin. So we have an issue of what we call ona, let's say financial fraud, or Gnevas Das, basically misrepresentation. It's a very complicated question because marriage is a kinyan, marriage is a binding relationship, is a binding commitment. And to whatever extent we compare it to a sale, so things get a little tricky because if I'm going to sell you something, so I have an obligation to be completely forthright to say, here exactly is what I'm selling you, here's what it's worth, here's what the problems are, etc., etc. But when you get involved in marriage, so on the one hand, we have these major issues which have to be revealed, which have to be brought forward. But on the other hand, if we're going to reveal every single problem before the first date, we're going to say every single issue, every single personality quirk that a person has, so nobody's ever going to get a date. Nobody's ever going to go out with anybody because, okay, the person had the bad luck of having a friend who knows everything about them. I'll go out with somebody else who doesn't have a friend who knows everything about them. So that's not going to be an efficient system. So how exactly are we going to compare the two systems? How are we going to say that the same system of honesty that we would have, let's say, in a business deal, we have to bring towards shidduchim as well? So that's a very complicated question. It's a question that draws upon a lot of judgment, and there's a whole discussion in the poskim about what needs to be revealed and when it needs to be revealed. Some things need to be revealed before there is a commitment to marry, but not necessarily before the first date, under the understanding that, again, somebody is going to say, well, if this person has a flaw, whoever thought somebody would have a flaw, I'll go marry somebody else who presumably doesn't have any flaws, not realizing that everybody has flaws. So before they start dating, maybe certain things shouldn't be revealed until it gets later on. While other things that are more major, a person wouldn't want to even get involved to begin with, so then unless they really are fully informed. So those kind of things would have to be brought up earlier in the process. The Stipler Gaon in his commentary to Maseches Yevamos has a very interesting explanation about how this works. It says, because normally, so when it comes to, again, the comparison to business, so let's say I sell you a car, and I tell you the car is worth $10,000, and you pay $10,000, and then you see that there are problems with it, it was only worth $2,000. So that's really gezel. I really basically stole $8,000 from you by inflating the value of the car. That would for sure be a problem. So somebody who would commit to a marriage not knowing what's there, and they wouldn't get involved if they had known. If they had known what was going on, if they had known what the issue was, they wouldn't get involved to begin with. So that's for sure a very serious problem. But there's a lower level of problem. That let's say, for example, let's say I sell you a car, and I sell you the car for $2,000. But you didn't know about the problem, so you thought you were getting a great deal. You thought you were getting a car that's worth much more. Well, nice, you would have bought it anyway. You would have paid the same money and you would have bought the car anyway, but you thought you were getting a better deal than you were actually getting. So that's actually a problem of Gnevas Das. So how come that doesn't follow through when it talks about marriage? How come when two people are getting married, so even though people afterwards, when they find out the information afterwards, they say, well, okay, we'll stick with it. They're happy they did it anyway, even though they didn't know before about this problem. So how come we don't apply the same logic of Gnevas Das to that? So the Stipler explains, as you probably could guess, because people are different than cars, because human beings are fundamentally different, and they're not so interchangeable. So the example he gives is, let's say you were to buy this car for $2,000, and you thought it was better than it was. And even though you were to say, okay, I'll keep it anyway, I'll still pay the $2,000, and I'll still keep it, even after I find out about the flaw, still, what if I, the seller, were to say to you, you know what? I'll trade you for a perfect car. I have a perfect car in my lot. I'll give you the perfect car that's worth more, and you'll take that instead. So then presumably you'll say, yes, okay, fine, why shouldn't I take the perfect car? But let's say somebody marries a spouse, and they're happy for 10 years, and they find out that there are some flaws which they didn't know about beforehand, but they still don't regret it. They still would have done it. So the model breaks down, because you can't say to this happy husband or wife, you know what, I'll trade you. Give me your spouse, and I'll give you a perfect spouse that doesn't have any of the flaws that you found out about later. And even though you don't want to get divorced, but I'll trade you for a perfect one, and that'll be a perfect resolution. So that doesn't work in the real world. In the real world, people are not interchangeable, and all the packages are too complex for such an analysis. So the whole comparison breaks down. So there are certain things which are considered to be normal human qualities which don't rise to the level of requirement to reveal. And there are other things which are either more objectively serious or more subjectively serious, but the person getting involved expresses that it's a concern to them, and then that shifts the equation. The Klausenberger Rebbe in his Tshuvas Divrayatziv has a little bit of a strange statement where he talks about some of the more minor issues, some of the things that are less objectively problematic. He says there is a minig to ignore. There's a custom to be malimayin, to hide your eyes from some of these things that are less objectively problematic. And there's a contemporary posek, the Tshuvas Yashiv Yitzchak, who's a Klausenberger chassid as well. So he discusses that. He says the expression the Gemara has, minig mevatel halacha, that even the strict din may be one way, but sometimes the minig overrides it. So what's he talking about? So presumably what he means is that, again, dealing with real life, with human beings, so since everybody has problems, everybody has flaws, so if everybody's going to reveal everything up front, nobody's ever going to get married. So even though, strictly speaking, in other contexts, there may be more of a disclosure rule, but the way society needs to work is there has to be some level of turning around, some level of not paying attention to every little detail, so that informs a little bit how the discussions take place. So those are some of the issues in terms of the Lashon Hara perspective. So in terms of what needs to be revealed and some of the broader guidelines, which again are very complex, but some of the broader issues, those are some of the perspectives that come into the equation. And if we have time, we'll look at some of the specific cases of how, what some of the poskim said and some of the specific issues. But just to quickly address the second set of issues, so the issues of professional ethics. So separate, even if there was no concept of Lashon Hara, even if there were no prohibitions that would address things like this in general, so what about the fact that there's a professional situation here? Or before we get to that, what if, let's say, the doctor made an independent commitment to the patient? The patient came to the doctor, before we get into the general rule of confidentiality, but let's say the patient said to the doctor, "Doctor, I have to tell you I have a problem, and I want you to promise me you're not going to tell anyone. I ask you, I'm telling you it's confidential, I'm asking you to make a promise to me that you're not going to tell anyone." So is that a binding issue or not? So is that a binding shvua? So if it's something that really is dangerous to somebody else, or if this person is going to pose a threat to somebody else, so then it's a real question whether or not such a commitment is binding, whether or not such an oath, even though normally we have a prohibition, the Torah tells us, lo yachal devaro, that we're not allowed to profane our words, so to speak, we're not allowed to violate our commitments. But if the issue is that you have an obligation to protect somebody else, so then it's a good question whether or not such a commitment is binding. It seems to be, the Ramah seems to say explicitly, that if somebody promises, I'm not going to testify about you, in a case where he has to testify, so he says that oath is not binding. That's something that violates the Torah, and it's not a binding oath. So strictly speaking, it would sound like the Ramah is explicitly addressing this situation. It's a question whether or not he really is. There's a whole discussion whether or not that really is the case, because it could be that he's talking more explicitly in a Beis Din setting where there's a clear mitzvah in the Torah to testify. There's a whole discussion, the commentaries on the side of the Shulchan Aruch quote from the Tshuvas Mahariv, that he said if somebody promised somebody else he's not going to testify something about him, so then he should get the person to release him from the vow and then testify. So the whole discussion later poskim have, so why does he say this much? Why do you have to get permission to be released from the vow? The vow shouldn't be binding in the first place. You should be able to say it because of the mitzvah that's involved. So the whole discussion when exactly there is a mitzvah and when there isn't a mitzvah. Yitzchak Zilberstein has an essay about this. It was printed in one of the Torah journals, HaBe'er, where he discusses that there are sometimes some reasons why it's not clear that there's an absolute tension or there's an absolute opposition between the mitzvah and the commitment, because, for example, it may not be an absolute testimony like the Torah is talking about. It's more of a subtle situation. Also, when the person took the oath, he didn't take an oath to violate the Torah. At the time, it was neutral information. At the time, it wasn't hurting anybody else. It only came up later that it was a situation that was hurting somebody else. So there are technical reasons why maybe the vow might be indeed binding. So then there's a whole discussion, maybe the vow should, you should go to somebody to have it undone, Heter Nedarim, whether or not Heter Nedarim is possible. So there is a little bit of a tricky tension there, that on the one hand there is an obligation to protect other people. There may be some issue of working around a vow which may be binding depending on how we understand it and depending on how absolute it was. And of course in a professional context, so it doesn't have to wait for somebody to specifically make a commitment, but there is a presumption that doctors enter into of confidentiality. That's a basic premise of the profession. So then the question is whether or not that's going to be a binding problem. So many of the poskim felt that it's not something that overrides the issue of somebody else being hurt. Tzitz Eliezer has a number of tshuvas where he says that he thinks especially a doctor who is God-fearing, when he takes on this commitment, he explicitly has in mind that he's not going to observe it if it's going to hurt somebody else. There's been some issues, some of the posts can talk about whether it's a question of gezel, you know, the question of whether you're perhaps stealing from the patient. The patient comes to you and pays you money and says, I'm paying you money under these circumstances, under these understandings, and then you violate that, so is that a problem of gezel? So that's a question that probably isn't, especially if you're acting on behalf of the patient, so that makes it a little bit easier, because then one can make the case that ultimately this is really what he wants, even if it's not what he said. But even when it's a question of saving somebody else, so then there is still what to rely on, that that's not called gezel per se. But there are other questions, even if we assume, like the Tzitz Eliezer says, that it's not something that we necessarily would considered to be a part of the vow the person committed to. So there's still a question of other issues. There's still other problems if a person's going to violate the premise of confidentiality. So then there are other issues. For example, the question of whether other patients will stop coming to him or stop coming to doctors in general. So that is a concern. That's something that has to be weighed. Some of the postmen thought it was a far-off concern. Other postmen thought it wasn't such a far-off concern. And therefore, for example, Rav Ariel in his Tshuvas Ba'olah Shel Torah has a discussion about this where he assumes that there is a legitimacy to a doctor evaluating what effect this will have on his practice, on the profession in general. That's also going to involve very much a balance of whether somebody is posing an absolute, direct, immediate danger to somebody else versus some of the other considerations that may come into play. And of course, also involved is the doctor in theory could lose his job over this. So the doctor loses his job and the doctor is not able to treat patients anymore. So then again, it's a question how much of a difference that's going to make. So that's also part of the tricky evaluation, how imminent, how clear and present is the danger to somebody else, and how absolute is the trade-off between saving somebody else's life, or is it something less than that, and whatever obligations that the doctor has in terms of losing his livelihood. So that many postmen thought you're not obligated to give up your livelihood in terms of an obligation like protecting somebody else. That's a whole discussion. Lo samar al dam reyecha, strictly speaking, is a prohibition in the Torah, which many postmen understand you have to give up all of your money for. But in this case, many postmen thought there was a more restricted understanding, either because it's passive, or because it's not absolute, or because of various other reasons, where there wouldn't necessarily be an obligation to give up one's money in order to fulfill this prohibition of lo samar al dam reyecha, including the fact also that it's not necessarily always clear that we're talking about a situation of absolute harm. And also the broader definition of lo samar al dam reyecha that we mentioned before from the Rambam, that includes any type of threat to any type of physical threat, any type of material threat. So not all poskim understood that. Some poskim understood it to be only specifically loss of life. So there are those who would suggest if it's not absolute loss of life, there might be more grounds to be lenient in terms of factoring other considerations. I think I'm supposed to take questions in 4 minutes, so just to quickly mention some of the cases that poskim talked about. Again, this part of the judgment, it's interesting to note, so it would seem like it's kind of a mixed bag. So if you look through the halakhic literature, so you find many, many different cases where poskim took up some of these issues and came up with different perspectives, and it's part of the judgment is to be exposed to a lot of this literature to try to see what types of positions were taken. So, for example, the Chalkes Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Reich, has a tshuva where he talks about a young man who was diagnosed with cancer, and in the case he's talking about, he himself doesn't know it. The patient doesn't know, but the doctor knows, and the patient is engaged, must become engaged to a girl, and the doctor knows that he's not going to live for more than another year or two, and he's not going to be able to have children. So then he thought for sure that would be a case where one would be obligated to reveal the information. By contrast, there's a not such well-known sefer, the Tshuvas Berkus Reuven Shlomo, for Baruch Reuven Shlomo Schlesinger, where he talks about a situation where a woman had surgery in order to remove a tumor, and it was completely removed, but now she has to take pills to make sure it doesn't come back. So he thought in such a case there was a stronger reason not to have to reveal it, because if the assumption is that the situation is generally over and it's being controlled with pills, and in theory it doesn't have to have any effect whatsoever on the husband's life, and maybe even he could never know about it, so in situations where that's the case, where it doesn't have to impact on the marital life, and the spouse doesn't have to know anything about, or could in theory live a whole life and not know exactly what's going on, not have any idea what's going on, so that's another example where sometimes poskim thought you didn't have to tell. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he talks about a young woman who hasn't had any menstrual cycle. And the question is if that should be a presumption that she's not going to be able to have children. And he says there's a case where the doctor told her that after she gets married, it's likely that she will start seeing cycles. So then Rav Moshe thought in that case she wouldn't have to reveal, because he thought that it's not at all definite that you're not going to be able to have children. And he says, and even if it means it'll take a little bit longer, but that they will have some children, so there's the difference between some children and a lot of children is not the same as no children. So that can't be taken as such an absolute type of chisaron where you necessarily assume there's an obligation to say. But in the case where there's an absolute impossibility to have children, to post like the Tzitzeliezer and others, basically take it as a given that you for sure would have to reveal. So these are some of the examples. There are something much more to talk about. A lot of the literature also is about the question we mentioned before of, let's say, if somebody's going to be a driver and he has epilepsy and there's a good chance he's a danger to other people by driving. So here Rav Avi Yosef has a truth about this, Tzitzeliezer has a truth about it as well, and they all take the attitude that that's a case of a clear and present danger, and therefore there's certainly an obligation to inform the authorities and to not assume that there's an issue of Lashon Hara or of confidentiality in such a case. There's a lot more to talk about than many other such cases, but we are out of time. So we'll stop now for questions. Hi, I'll let Rabbi Kelman choose the...
It seems this topic is very important and very wide-ranging in our community, ranging from civic communities that simply cannot deal with children with disabilities that put them away in group homes, to psychological problems with bipolar, schizophrenia, to even simple mundane problems or general problems like family members who have inflammatory bowel disease. And this topic ranges from that scenario to simple, easier topics to deal with. My question to you and perhaps this audience is, what is wrong with us, just in respect, why we can't deal, as opposed to other societies that deal with imperfections? What is our core problem that we cannot accept imperfections in us as human beings?
It's a very serious and important question, and he asked it through the whole, so I'll let people as a whole address it afterwards. But I will note, now I'm not equipped to really deal with that issue as a whole, but I will note that one of the points that you mentioned really contains an inherent paradox, which is very problematic. Because, for example, if you maintain that you have to conceal family members who have problems, so you're making two statements which are mutually exclusive. You're saying that that person's existence should be an impediment to a shidduch, which clearly we have, clearly a very problematic statement. But then, if you believe that, so then you shouldn't be permitted to conceal it. So, mimanashach, if it's so significant, then you should be obligated to reveal it. So it's certainly halakhically and theologically and morally problematic to maintain both those positions, to have a position that the existence of such family members should be such a shanda, and that you're not allowed to tell, that you have to conceal it. Those are mutually exclusive and, I think, touch a little bit upon the problem.
We have society and not dealt with this properly.
I think you're right.
The core problem is with us.
As always. Right. Can't argue with that.
I have a practical and very everyday thing that you brought up about the neurologist in practice with the epileptic patient.
Right.
In any situation, an epileptic patient is always, in some circumstance, statistically, predisposed to some breakthrough seizure. In New York State, unless you are given a document from the patient asking to fill out for a license renewal, you don't have an obligation to tell the state in the motor vehicle department. As a matter of fact, I think that's a violation of confidence. And you can tell the patient all you want, but you can't convince, because cars are livelihood for most people in New York State.
Right.
The question is a dilemma, the true doctor's dilemma, and the only victim is the doctor.
So it's a phenomenal dilemma, and we can't really... We don't really have the structure to address it properly, because we can only address it really from kind of a dual perspective. But on the one hand, what does the halacha require of you? Weighing the fact that there's a damage to others, you have information within a certain setting which is presumed confidential, but on the other hand, damage to others, that type of balance. And then what is the state of New York or whatever require of you, whichever context it is, and then how do you balance your obligation and the consequences that you will suffer from the state of New York from answering the first question in isolation. And that's a little bit what we've been addressing, you know, not addressing fully because of the complexity of the issue, but the question of, are you obligated to lose your livelihood? Are you obligated to enter into a situation where other people are not going to come to you because this has come into the equation? So these are legitimate factors on the one hand. On the other hand, again, if it's a clear and present danger where somebody really poses an absolute risk, but there's always, again, an issue of statistics and percentages, which is part of the question, but this is part of why it's a sticky issue that we're trying to balance. But the structure doesn't exist to unify the two sides. We have the halachic factors we're trying to figure out. The state may have different sets of requirements. So we as individuals have to first figure out, I guess, what the halacha wants from us. And if that's at odds with what the state wants from us, so then how do we deal with the potential consequences that may come from that situation? I'll let Dr. Kelman decide.
Two comments. First, I would object to the question. Somewhat, because I don't think there's anything wrong with us.
Okay.
I think that the problem is complex, and B, we have
it is complex.
And B, we have certain values that the secular society doesn't have that we're trying to preserve, and necessarily those values sometimes are in conflict. And we maybe have a problem resolving those conflicts, and that's why different segments of society are acting one towards the right or the left in resolving those values that are in conflict. I don't think there's anything wrong with having conflicting values. I think we have there's an issue in terms of how we struggle to resolve those conflicting values.
Right. Point is well taken, although I think it does, the paradox is still true. The question of what judgment that make, right? But the paradox of, correct. I hear that. The question of, if there's something that you believe is so significant, then it will make it more unjust to conceal it. That essential paradox is going to be there.
The second thing that I would like to raise is to make the situation even more complex. So the phone call that I received on the way up here this weekend. A nurse called me about a patient who I share in common with a physician who does home visits, and who alerted me to the fact that the physician is prescribing painkillers to the patient. When she comes to the patient's home, the pill count is markedly deficient in those painkillers, and after the physician has visited this patient. And the physician happens to be Jewish. So now you have the issue of patient confidentiality and professional confidentiality conflicting, and the issue that was just raised before, namely in terms of livelihood and state, our physician's responsibility to report to the state. So these issues are, again, I'm not pointing out asking for a solution, I'm just trying to show you that the complexities override and continue to override one another, and the whole point of my statement now is that I think we need to have some sort of mechanism where we can discuss these issues and we can have these issues resolved on an ongoing basis. Because we as physicians in the trenches are receiving these problems all day long. Yeah. And woefully, the rabbinic community has not set up a structure whereby we can easily access information or have at our hand the ability of physicians to fall back on the rabbinic counseling to receive answers, which we need sometimes almost on an instantaneous basis or on a very short-term basis.
Right.
And I would urge the rabbinic community to somehow develop some sort of mechanism beyond the standard Shiloh mechanism that we ask your local rabbi, etc., because that becomes very deficient at times. To deal with these situations as they become more complex and more threatening to the livelihood of the physicians themselves, I think we need to have a big community look at this in a more serious fashion.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Just to address very briefly some of the points that you raised, so again, the point well taken about whether it casts a judgment on the values or not, I think the examples that he was talking about were a little bit more absolute. We all understand that there are certain conflicting values, but again, that central paradox I will reiterate. In terms of difficulty in getting clear answers to some of these questions, I think that's clearly a tremendous issue. It seems to be, and I'm not a doctor,